Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, two wars. The fallout from 9/11 has been expressed in many ways during the decades since the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. To some degree, the event has changed our lexicon. 9/11, Ground Zero, for example. It's also forced us to examine just how much we value our first responders, the police and firefighters especially, and our military. And for a few weeks, the tragedies that unfolded that day brought us closer together. But even as the attacks burned a hole in the heart of a vibrant city and wounded our national psyche, they also began to reverberate in more than a series of reactions, but also in how we express our culture, what makes up our culture, what will be studied someday to learn what made us tick at this time, our art, our music and poetry, our film, and of course, our television. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from composer, singer, songwriter Eric Nesda and also Salon.com co-founder and senior writer Laura Miller. Right now, we welcome film critic Frank Gabrania. Frank has been the film critic for the Columbus Dispatch since 1987. Prior to that, he covered film, theater, and popular music for the now defunct Columbus Citizen Journal and twice was named best newspaper critic for large circulation publications by the Ohio Society of Professional Journalists. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Also with us, Christopher Bedford. Christopher is the chief curator of exhibitions at OSU's Wexner Center for the Arts, where he is a curator for this fall's exhibition, The Natural World, A Common Thread, and Ecocycle. Before joining the Wexner Center's curatorial team in 2008, he was a curator with the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and also curated for the Getty Museum in L.A. He has published numerous essays, book reviews, editorials, and exhibition reviews in a variety of publications, and he's also a contributing editor to the Los Angeles-based contemporary art journal Extra. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Question for our listeners. We have a busy hour, but I want to hear from you if you have something you want to talk to us about the arts and film or music. Has something inspired you or something inspired 9/11 really struck you? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Christopher Bedford, after an event like 9/11, at first, you know, it was absolutely impossible to believe it could be true for a lot of people. People directly affected by it, and the entire nation was in a state of shock. We're in a state of shock. So it seemed like, too, at the same time, there was a hesitancy to make any art connected to the event. It seemed exploitative to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. I think one interesting thing to bear in mind surrounding the delicacies and sensitivities of this entire subject is that we didn't need visual art to verify for us what had happened, or to embellish on what we all knew had happened, or to give us a new vision of what had occurred. I think some of the estimates were that 2 billion people watched those events transpire live on television, or you know, online, or were listening to the radio. And a lot of even the verbal descriptions were incredibly vivid and incredibly animate. So I think the space for visual art in particular to contribute quickly to any discussion around those images was fairly limited. I think it's also really important to bear in mind that contemporary art often involves moving images in and of itself. So the idea that an artist working in film or video would be able to add to anything that we had already collectively experienced seemed like a total fallacy. If you look back at the history of art, for example, Picasso's Guernica was painted very shortly after the events on which it was based. But I think there was more of a need at that point to create a document that could be collectively experienced because there wasn't already in existence that collective document. I think we all have that. And that's the definitive account. So the big question for artists is, what can they, what should they contribute to that memory, and how should we relate to it? That's the quandary, and I think that's the factor that's limited the amount of visual art there to engages directly with the legacy, the sort of image legacy of 9/11. That's something I've thought about a great deal since the event, mostly because I'm a curator, and I believe that makes a curator is a kind of public intellectual. And one of my commitments as a curator is to art as something that's very socially embedded, very socially connected. And so I want to believe that it has something to say about even the most vital and most sensitive issues for us culturally. I don't think too much of that has been done in the last 10 years, but I am hopeful that those things are possible going forward.
My guest is Christopher Bedford, Chief Curator of Exhibitions at OSU's Wexner Center for the Arts. Also with me, Frank Gabrina, critic at the Columbus Dispatch. Christopher, what about artists using or art as a form of protest?
Mm-hmm.
Did that come out a little sooner, or what role did that play in this?
Mm-hmm. I think there were artists who took up some of the issues tangentially related to 9/11. So the increased American military presence around the world, increased American military activity around the world, and there were artists, both American and European, who took issue with some of those decisions and created work that was in some way a protest against those policies. Thomas Hirschhorn, the Swiss artist, is a prime example, and somebody who is very prominent in the international circuit and just represented Switzerland in the Venice Biennale, which is one of the most prominent platforms for contemporary art in the world. So I do think that was a part of the response to, our national response to that event. But I think, in generally speaking, the engagement with the actual day, with those actual images, there's been a kind of tentativeness and a desire to be as sensitive as possible, and that's resulted in very little work, and I think that this is right and justifiable. That has a direct relationship to those events. For example, there are two of the world's most preeminent painters, Luc Tuymans, who's Belgian, and Gerhard Richter, who's German, both of whom have produced paintings which have a somewhat oblique relationship to the images of the towers or billowing smoke. But I think even in those two cases, and as renowned and accomplished as those painters are, I think there's a skepticism about the degree to which that medium and those artists can deal with the sort of image memory of that event. So I think we're yet to see anything in the more traditional media of sculpture and painting that has a successful or deepening relationship to that subject matter.
I wonder what we'll see from the children of 9/11, not children who were born, but children, not even children who are directly affected, but children who have lived their entire life with 9/11 as a defining moment. Maybe 20 years, 30 years away, there's going to be something emerging that we can't imagine now.
I believe in that possibility wholeheartedly, and I think that the reason that's likely to happen is that their relationship to the event and the way they manage to materialize that relationship will become more and more natural and perhaps more and more oblique. And to me, it's the problem with the engagement to this point, through visual means at least, has been an occasional tendency to be too literal. And that, to me, starts to step into the territory of being reiterative relative to the imagery that already exists. I think the more distance we have, the more sensitivity there is to the event, the more oblique the address becomes, I think the more convincing and the deeper the response is likely to be. So I do think you're correct in saying that it's going to be children born in the aftermath of the event that will produce the most resonant response, ultimately. I will also say, though, that there are certain artists, Ellsworth Kelly, for example, who did produce statements, in my mind, that were very moving, very resonant in the aftermath. And the very quick example is that when there was a call for proposals for a memorial for Ground Zero, Ellsworth Kelly, who's one of America's most eminent living painters, sent a cutout photograph of an aerial view of Ground Zero that was published in the front cover of the New York Times. And he either sent it to the mayor or to the committee overseeing the memorial. And he had inscribed onto the top of that image an enormous patch of green. And his proposal was simply to turn it into a park, somewhere where people could gather and collectively understand the events and what had happened. It was both a beautiful image, and it struck me as something that in the world could be an effective gesture. It wasn't eventually realized, but as a memento or an image of could have happened to me, it still resonates.
Joyce and Columbus, welcome to the show. You had a granddaughter. A granddaughter wrote something about 9/11 at the time.
Yes, my granddaughter is 8 years old, and she wrote this about that when she was eight. And it's dedicated to her teacher, whose birthday is September 11th. This is the poem she wrote. Broken. It was one of those days, one of those moments, where everything was perfect. Everyone was happy. Nothing could go wrong, it felt. But soon, so many people's dreams would melt. Broken buildings, broken hearts. But what we did was take all the parts and turn them into one big heart. That was written by my 8-year-old granddaughter.
Thank you very much, Joyce, for sharing that. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. That was pretty good, Christopher.
Yeah. I was quite taken aback. I was hoping you wouldn't ask, me to speak immediately afterwards.
I know. Let's turn to Frank Gabrania. Frank,
Christopher, Ann asked you to speak so she wouldn't have to.
That's
what a host does on this program.
Frank, let's talk about popular culture and how it responded as if it's a thing, responded in the immediate aftermath of the tragedy. What the Hollywood films, the comic books that reference 9/11, what's your take on that 10 years later?
Where Christopher is talking about the literal nature of art and how that can be a disadvantage in this type of contrast. Film, for example, and beyond it, television is even more literal in its depiction of anything. But I thought a lot about this in relation to other tragedies, films based on it, things like that. One thing that struck me is looking back over the 20th century, the major events, major tragic events, it seems to have taken about 30 years before someone gets around to making a definitive film about it, at least talking in terms of mainstream film. The 1906 San Francisco earthquake, the movie San Francisco came out in 1938, 30 years later. Titanic, there were actually silent films about the sinking, but no one really made a mainstream film about it till 1953, and that took place in 1912. Pearl Harbor, 1941, you get a movie the size of Tora, 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 I think 1973 or 4. It may well be that no one will make a definitive literal film on this subject for 20 more years. And to some case, I think that makes sense because I think you need a new audience to form for things like that. Because we who still have it fresh in our memories, who were adults at the time and were glued to the television and read everything about it, it's still so fresh in our memories, we don't need a recreation of the events of themselves. So that I think, and besides the fact that there was so much video that day and so well made, and there have been documentaries put together of this program, that no one needs to make that kind of film. You also have the case with Hollywood filmmaking, for example, where it is primarily a commercial industry, and you need to recoup your immense budget on these things, and we're still looking for the audience that wants to go into the theater and spend money to watch this again. They watched it at home. It's a horrifying event, and it's very uncomfortable to sit through it again. Now, there have been some films made, and some of them went into mainstream circulation, but they did not draw huge audiences. In 2006, at the beginning of the year, was a film about the film Flight 93, which was about the fourth hijacked plane, the one that went down in the field in Pennsylvania. That was made on the A&E network, and had a small budget, did what it could.
Let's hear a cut from that right now.
Do you have Flight 93 or United 93?
Oh, they're two different things. Thank you.
See, well, you got ahead of me there.
That's why I invite the sharp guys.
excuse me. About 3 months later came United 93, which was a mainstream theatrical film made by Paul Greengrass, an excellent British director who also made two of the Bourne movies with Matt Damon. And this was a terrific movie, You have a clip
from that? I do have a clip from that. This is a clip from the trailer. The flight United 93 was the fourth plane hijacked on September 11th, and the movie is a recreation of the heroic acts of 40 passengers to retake the plane from the hijackers. Let's listen.
We have a plane headed toward the Capitol.
What the hell is wrong out there?
May we engage, sir?
I am on a plane that has been hijacked.
Yes, sir. I got F-16s turning and burning towards Washington.
Two planes just hit the World Trade Center.
Nobody's going to help us.
We have to put something right now.
Colonel, I need rules of engagement.
Do we shoot this flight down?
We have to do it now, because we know what happens if we just sit here and do nothing.
That is a cut from the trailer of the movie United 93. We're going to continue our conversation about the impact on our culture and our arts through the rest of the show. But first, I want to thank Christopher Bedford. Christopher, thanks for joining us again today. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Christopher Bedford, he's the chief curator of exhibitions at OSU's Wexner Center for the Arts. Frank Cabrera of the Columbus Dispatch is going to stay with us. I hope you do, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This Sunday, an NPR News special, coverage of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. Join me for memorial services and reports from around the country. Then Neil Conan hosts a three-hour call-in program, letting Americans put the day in perspective. That's special coverage from NPR News, the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Sunday, beginning at 8 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News. 66 degrees with a chance of rain today, a high of 75. Also a chance of rain tonight and a low of 60 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are possible for Saturday, a high of 76.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting first-time author Vanessa Diffenbaugh, reading from her novel, The Language of Flowers, Monday evening, September 12th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My blue Manhattan. She sang me like a child, how sweet. Fire and rain on the street.
That was the song My Blue Manhattan by Ryan Adams. It was written after 9/11 and featured in the TV show Rescue Me. We'll talk about Rescue Me in a few minutes with Frank Cabrera. Today we're talking about the impact of 9/11 on arts and culture and how our music, theater, films, and literature still grapple with the personal and national tragedy that resulted from the events of that day 10 years ago and the awareness that there will always be a before and after 9/11. Still with us, as I said, Dispatch film critic Frank Cabrera. Welcome again, Frank.
Thanks, Anne.
And also joining us now is Salon.com co-founder and senior writer Laura Miller. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thank you.
In the past 10 years, Laura, you've reviewed a number of novels that include 9/11 as a main subject or reference 9/11 in some way. This must have a special meaning for you. You're still living in New York City, right?
Yes, I was here on the day and standing in the street watching it happen. So it does and it doesn't. I mean, I think that that there's 9/11, the actual event, and the deaths of the people who were in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the Flight 93. But then there's also all of the sort of cultural stuff that's kind of accumulated around it that sometimes makes it hard to really see the event of 9/11 itself.
Were you dreading a little bit what might emerge in the immediate aftermath?
You mean culturally?
Yeah, in terms of exploitative stuff. There's comic books and illustrate,
yeah,
all the flotsam and jetsam of what could have been, and I was wondering if as doing what you do as a critic and dreading a little bit what might be coming out.
Well, you know, it's not something that actually I like to spend a lot of time thinking about because mm-hmm. it was a really strange and surreal and disruptive time, you know, that day. And then, you know, at least the week after, it was very, very weird. I don't know that I was dreading it so much. In fact, I think afterwards, a lot of people were I'm mostly a book critic. And mm-hmm. so a lot of people were really hungry for what writers had to say, because 9/11 was this crime that was committed for the camera. And as a culture that loves images so much, and whose popular entertainment is about 60% watching big explosions, I think that it made people feel really queasy and uncertain about the culture of movies and television and just images in general, because we knew that those terrorists were sort of striking not only at real human lives, but at our kind of careless love of violent spectacles. And people have always seen literature as kind of an antidote to that. So I think at the time, I was really hungry for some kind of literary discussion of it, because it seemed like it would be able to sort of, short-circuit that really weird, kind of nauseating relationship between those photographs and American culture.
You especially praised Amy Waldman's first novel, The Submission. In your review, you wrote that the novel might not make a successful Hollywood film. As a popular entertainment, The Submission lacks heroic focus and a decisive notion of who's right and who's wrong. These are also the qualities that make The Submission so satisfying as a novel. What was it about?
Well, it was about it's not exactly about 9/11. The people never actually refer to it as that, but it's basically very similar to that attack. And it's about a controversy over a memorial. There's an anonymous competition where architects submit their designs for a memorial and anonymously. And this panel of artists and public officials and one widow of one survivor of someone who died in the attack pick a memorial design, and then it turns out that the man who designed it is an American Muslim, and it causes this huge controversy. And there's all this tension over, the architect feels like, why should he have to explain himself? He's an innocent person, and he never did anything, and he's an American, and he's offended by people asking him to withdraw just because he's a Muslim, and then everybody else is angry at him because he won't understand why they're offended. And so, it really is a great depiction of how we had tried to come to terms with 9/11 politically and culturally, and mostly kind of failed to really understand what happened.
Frank Abrania, what are the challenges, and what have they been? You talked about the literal interpretations of 9/11, if you will, or the depictions of it. What about interpreting it by way of Hollywood in the film industry?
Well, I don't know that there's been a great deal of interpretation. What Laura was just describing in that kind of context sounds like a movie that my son mentioned to me the other day. He had found on the internet. I'm sorry, I don't have the title right now, but it had to do with Muslim-American relations in some city in the wake of this. And I was mentioning at dinner last night that that's the kind of movie that I don't remember anybody making. And then he looked up on his phone while we're sitting there and found a title. And we couldn't trace it to any kind of widespread distribution. I think there have probably been many scripts written, some of them produced, and a few of them actually getting some kind of distribution that we who only see what shows up at the neighborhood multiplex never wind up seeing. So a lot of these subjects have been treated by somebody somewhere, probably where it's more relevant in their lives. But subjects like interpretations, what we've tended to get more in film anyway, are the literal recreations of the events, like we talked about United 93 mm-hmm. or Oliver Stone's film World Trade Center, about the two policemen who are trapped in the rubble and are eventually saved. But we also tend to get some movies lately that are more about grieving in the wake of this. Rain Over Me was a prominent one with Adam Sandler, of all people, who actually did a good job in it, and Don Cheadle, and other movies like that have fed off of the grief cycle on it. But it's very difficult to for film to figure out ways to treat this subject solemnly and give it the respect it deserves, and at the same time draw in an audience. In the cases of all these films that have been made directly or somewhat indirectly about the subject, none of them have broken any kind of box office records or even come close. And if you want to extend the whole 9/11 legacy to include the wars in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan, you get even a smaller audience wanting to go to those, so that The Hurt Locker, which takes place in Afghanistan, is still the smallest grossing movie ever to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. People did not want to go out and see a movie about Afghanistan. So as long as the audience isn't there wanting to go to see these, people are not going to make them. Television, that's, of course, a different story.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about arts and culture and the impact from 9/11. Our guests, Laura Miller, Salon.com co-founder and senior writer, and also Frank Gabrena, film critic for the Columbus Dispatch. Laura, there's a sprinkling of 9/11 in literature, though. It may not be about it. It may not even be per se influenced by it. But just take Julie. Or Julia, the blogger who was preparing every recipe in Julia Child's The Art of French Cooking, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. She had a scene in there about the day, and it wasn't put in the film. It didn't make it to the film. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if you, but it didn't make it to the film. But it was just sprinkled in there, and I've noticed that with. You know, here and there stories that just say, oh, it was, yeah, this happened, and that day this happened, but it doesn't really depend on it.
Well, I think that if you're talking, you know, Julie and Julia is of course, like a memoir. It's nonfiction. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, nonfiction, as a rule, has had a little bit easier of a time with 9/11 than fiction. Because nonfiction can address it directly, and fiction kind of gets stuck in a weird place where if you write a novel that is primarily about 9/11 and the characters are imaginary, it often seems weirdly opportunistic and inappropriate. But you can't write a novel about America since 2001 or, you know, in the first part of the 21st century. It doesn't acknowledge it, and so there is a tendency to feel like, well, you have to mention it, even if that's not really what your book is about. And then so you mention it in passing. It's almost like I always think of it as sort of genuflecting in a Catholic church. You mean you walk in to go talk to the priest or do whatever, but you have to genuflect in the aisle.
Right.
Well, you know, I'll agree with you. Anything having to do with the '60s had to mention the Kennedy assassination for a long time.
And so even people who don't have anything that meaningful to say about it feel like they have to acknowledge it, which it's a little bit weird. You know, I mean, it's interesting to think of, you know, in 30 years from now, if someone sets their novel in the first decade of this century, will they still feel like they have to describe their characters, you know, sitting in front of the TV? I mean, because for a lot of Americans, that's really what it consisted of, was sitting in front of the TV for like a week. And then in a lot of ways, going back to life as it was before. I mean, I sometimes wonder how different it really was. Things changed. We went to war and we had an economic collapse. And those things really affected us. But I don't know how many people walk around in their everyday life thinking about 9/11.
One of the things that happened, particularly in film, is it was that the impression of 9/11 without ever mentioning it. Frank Gabrena, Rendition is one of those movies. Mm-hmm. Another one is the television show 24. Can you talk about that a little bit, and then we'll listen to some of it?
When we first talked, or when you first mentioned this idea to me, that's the thing that came to me was where there has been a major cultural impact has been more on television than it has been in film. And the two things in particular, the series Rescue Me, which just concluded its eight-season run, 7 years, the other night with Dennis Leary as a firefighter, who is in a fictional fire station in New York City. So those men have direct memories of people who were killed in that situation, even though most of the series had more to do with Leary's character and what trouble he has with his ex-wife and things like that. But that brought some, I think has brought some attention to the role of first responders that we never really paid very much attention to until the day of the terrorist attack. And since then, they get a respect that I don't think they ever really received before. And that series is part of that respect. But the biggest cultural impact of any of these that have had has been the series 24. Although it had been in production before the events of 2001 and went on the air November of 2001, and it was only set up to be a thriller, an espionage thriller with Kiefer Sutherland's character running around the world stopping these terrorist attacks. As it went into its subsequent seasons, there was more and more issues of torture and stopping the terrorists with any means possible. And that's a reflection of a controversy still going on in our society that had had big impact on the audience.
Okay, let's hear a cut from 24 right now, and
get up against the door and sit on your hands.
Who are you? What do you want, money? I don't have much with me, but I'm sure I could find some.
Shut up. My name is Jack Bauer. Since midnight, my wife and daughter have been missing. I have reason to believe they're being held by a colleague of yours. This is your last chance. Where is my family?
Yeah, that might not have made it on television before 10 years ago.
You know, and I think that might have been from the first season, was it? Much of which was planned in advance, but it got a lot worse than that. So that there were groups around the world, after this thing went very popular globally, asking the producers of that show to tone down the violence in it. And political groups, because it was reflecting the controversy at the time as to how much torture is too much when it comes to fighting this type of enemy that we've never fought before, that no one's ever fought before. It's not a nation you can go to war against. You can't march your army in. It's splinter groups all over the country, and you have to do whatever you can to react to that. I mentioned 24 not because it's the best thing made about 9/11. That I think is still the film United 93 till somebody tops it, but because it's become the most widespread, won a lot of awards, had a big audience, ran for 8 seasons, big finish, and now there's still talk of a movie down the road. So it's not going to go away. But that's where the lingering issue has been, beyond personal interaction, has been the torture issue.
Laura Miller, you were less impressed with Jonathan Safran Foer's latest novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. It looks at the event through the eyes of a child whose father died in the World Trade Center. Talk about, you know, in the hands, in the mind of a child and the validity of that or invalidity of that.
Well, there are people who really like that book. That to me is what I think of when I think of an example of something that to me comes across and to many other people as kind of opportunistic. You think, well, why is this child, it ends with a photographic flip book of those famous photos of a man falling from the tower. And you're supposed to be able to flip it backwards so that the figure goes back up inside, and it's supposed to represent like the child's wish that things could be undone. And, it's a kind of a maudlin book that doesn't really explain why this child's loss is that different from the loss of a child whose father dies in a car accident or, you know, is shot by a maniac in the IHOP or whatever. You know, it felt like, you know, it was it more used this historical event than was really about the historical event, and that it used it in a kind of a really not that thoughtful and really sort of maudlin way. So for me, it very much didn't work. Although I have to acknowledge that there are people who felt like it was a meaningful use of that tragedy.
Laura Miller, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Laura Miller is a Salon.com co-founder and senior writer. Frank Cabrera, the Columbus Dispatch, is going to stay with us. Hope you will, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs a couple of songs in tribute to the men and women who have served since 9/11. And NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel tells behind-the-scenes stories about his recent reporting from Libya, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss supporters of Senate Bill 5 begin running television ads, lawmakers are closer to carving up Ohio's congressional districts, and is Columbus safer than it was on September 11, 2001? Tune in for Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern, a university that invests in the success of its students by offering more than $53 million in gift assistance annually. There's a College of Engineering visit day September 24th. Information is at onu.edu.
68 degrees with cloudy skies. There is a chance of rain today, a high of 75. A chance of rain tonight, a low of 60 degrees. About a 40% chance of rain for Saturday, maybe a thunderstorm, a high of 76. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
And if you got a phone, hey you, call home. If you got a voice, hey you, reach your.
That is the post-9/11 song, Hey You, by the Pittsburgh-based band, The Clarks. It's just one example of many of the songs that have been inspired by the tragedy. Still with us is Dispatch critic Frank Cabrera. Frank, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Joining us now to talk about the music of 9/11 is singer, songwriter, and composer, and Worthington native, Eric Nesda. Eric's post-9/11 song, True Heroes, which we'll hear in a few minutes, was selected for All States, All Stars, a national CD project sent to overseas troops. Eric and his work have been featured on Entertainment Tonight, ESPN, Nickelodeon, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC Radio Network, and in Sports Illustrated. He is also a regular Writers' Night performer at Nashville's famous venue for songwriters, the Bluebird Cafe. As a singer-songwriter, Eric was awarded the 2006 Ohioana Citation for Music Composition. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Glad to be here, Ann. Thank you.
Tell us how you composed Time for America. We played it at the top of the hour, and it's available online if people want to listen to it, but you were on your way to Kansas.
Yeah, I was had gotten a gig to address the Kansas Farm Bureau through my speaking and music, and it was an all-night drive. It was shortly after 9/11, and I was very uneasy about flying. So we drove, and I got about 2 hours sleep that night, and as I was coming in, these lyrics just came out of nowhere, and I wrote them down on a sheet of paper and played them that night, debuted them in Kansas. Interestingly enough, the lyrics came to me in a real moment of calm, which doesn't always happen. Sometimes you struggle for lyrics, but these just showed up, and it felt like it was meant to be written.
As a songwriter, after 9/11, did you feel this came in a moment of calm? But was there other times afterward that you thought, well, what am I going to say about this as a songwriter?
Well, I kind of joke sometimes that every songwriter since 9/11 has a 9/11 song, and they also have a song called Hold On. And as in the songwriting community, we laugh about that. But I think a lot of people, it's really like any tragedy or death. We all experience it our different ways, and we have our own needs to express them in our respective ways.
It isn't necessarily about public consumption.
No, it's not for me anyway. I mean, it's never about public consumption for me. It's about the need to express what's within. And oftentimes my songs are my teachers. Things will come out of me that musically and lyrically that perhaps I don't understand or where they came from. I don't understand the meanings. But once they become a part of me and I begin performing them and getting reaction, then I begin to understand that I grow from the song as well.
My guest is Eric Nezda, singer, songwriter, and composer. You heard his song at the top of the hour. And coming up, we're going to hear another song that he's written and will be performed with Arkady Gips, virtuoso violinist, who spent the past 2 years on Madonna's world tour. So stay with us for that. Eric, as an artist, the music and lyrics just came to you that day or on that trip, but how did you think about the impact on your audience? How did you decide to reveal it to your audience in Kansas City?
Well, it's always a risk.
Because how soon was it after the attacks?
It was probably a month, a little after a month. But it seemed like every single event I was part of for about a year and a half had a patriotic theme to it. We were all still shocked and really open to how each other was feeling and processing this. But, you know, anytime we sing anything, but especially the first time we debut it, it's always an immense risk. But I really felt compelled to do it. This one was received, you know, extremely well. It was what people had talked about and written to me about following. But I think we were in a state of mind at that point of receptivity as a culture.
After the attacks, when I was a columnist for the Dispatch, I heard from all sorts of visual artists who wanted me to write about their work. And a new batch seemed to spring up every year, you know, on the anniversary about this time. And I believe to them the work was profound, but I was wondering how you separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to the impact of the magnitude of 9/11 as an artist. How do you, when you're looking at the panorama of the last 10 years and the music that's come out of it, how do you judge it?
Well, I have a little different perspective on it now after listening to Frank, and Frank and I talked a little bit before the show, and he brought up, I asked him, about his thoughts, and he said, well, how should we react? And I think that's really a valid thing. And it underscores for me that it comes down to how we each process it and feel about it. So I told him my preference, and that's the word that I now find myself using, my preference would have been that artists and certainly the culture would have continued to have been more receptive to reflective thinking about it, a little more internal soul searching, and my preference would be that we not have turned in a direction of further escapism. And I think that was, when we look at a lot of the music that's come out, sure, there have been songs about 9/11, but about a year afterwards, it seems to me that we snapped back with even more vigor towards escapist entertainment, particularly in music. I feel that's unfortunate, but yet, you know, the 9/11 events were so catastrophic and traumatic, maybe we don't want to revisit them.
You know, the Clarks from Pittsburgh, we played that song at the beginning. I liked the song. I'd never heard it before. My producer, Amy Jurevich, brought it to my attention. There must be so much out there that hasn't been brought to our attention. Frank,
well, I'm sure there are thousands. I think, as Eric said, probably every singer-songwriter has a 9/11 song. But something that was occurring to me as you were saying that, did you notice that a bunch came within about a year and a half And then for a long time, I'll bet you didn't have people come up and say, I just wrote a 9/11 song,
right.
Let's say 3 years ago.
Right.
But now, possibly with the publicity on the 10th year anniversary, there may be another splurge, and then it's going to go away. The primary output in this country culturally is escapism.
Right.
You're disappointed in it in music, and I'm disappointed in it in film. But often I enjoy it while it's going on, and there's always some rebalance. We get down to the Oscar films at the end of the year, we'll get some serious stuff. So it's never all escapism. It's never all one thing or another. But in terms of films or songs commemorating this event, I think there's a mood. There's a you know, the lyrics came to you. It was on your mind. It was moving at the time, and that's the way emotion comes out. And probably in ways that, let's say, a double-dip recession doesn't cause you to write a song. But
right.
But things that happen like that, and this was as emotional an event as any of us have ever lived through. So I think it's, I think everything that pretty much has happened is logical according to this culture. And you may be a little disappointed that it wasn't more of one, you know, more in one direction. But, you know, there's no reason why people 3 years ago shouldn't have still been going, you know, overcome with the emotion of it,
right.
Unless they were there. New Yorkers are different, and I understand that. And we never mention the Pentagon, do we? That never comes up.
I mentioned it at the top, but you're right. It's often forgotten, not to mention the Pennsylvania. There was nobody there, but it's still
You
place.
Know, it isn't comparable to what happened at the World Trade
Center.
Absolutely not. We know that.
We didn't see it the same way, and
it wasn't
visualized the same way.
Well, and it wasn't as huge and everything like that.
My guests are Frank Gabrania. He's a critic for the Columbus Dispatch, and also Eric Nesda, singer, songwriter, and composer. We have a few more minutes. If you have a question or comment for either of them, we welcome them. If you want to tell us about something that's influenced you since 9/11, some art form, sculpture, painting, music, film, literature, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I don't know if you heard the poem that the lady read at the beginning, their grandchild had written. But that was pretty moving, and I was wondering, what is your sense about what children can absorb at this point in terms of maybe sometimes music is a better way to dish it up than a lot of other ways?
Yeah. Well, when it happened, I was watching it, and my daughter was on her first day of preschool. And so I knew that the world was never going to be the same for her. You know, I also teach part-time at Ohio Wesleyan in public speaking, and a lot of the students for a little while afterwards, 4 or 5 years, were talking about it a lot, and how a lot of them are from the East Coast and how it had affected them on a personal way. I haven't heard much about it since then, to be honest, since about 2007 or 8. But what I guess what I'm concluding is that it's something that we all experienced on a very personal level. I think ultimately that's the way we're working it out. As a culture, it's almost too big to get our arms around us. So I think we're left to really think about how it affected us personally, what changes we want to make internally, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
Eric, 9/11 influenced the impact of work produced before the attacks, too. Can you tell us a little bit about your impression of that? That some song, I knew that I'm Proud to Be an American was going to, you know, get switched on almost
right.
immediately, but there was others out there, other kinds of music that had deeper meaning for us.
The best example I can use is because I'm closest to it, is one of my songs called True Heroes. And it was a song that was written 5 or 6 years before 9/11. Arcadi and I would play it all over, and it reached people, but I don't think to the level. In fact, I know not to the level that it did following 9/11. And Frank was talking earlier about how there's new respect for first responders. And I think that as a result of 9/11, we totally changed, redefined our definition of a hero. A hero is no longer somebody who achieved something great or big. A hero perhaps became someone who gave of himself or herself for the benefit of others, and that was really embodied in the work of the first responders. So that did change.
as a performer, after 9/11, you knew you were going to be out there. Just very quickly, did that song occur to you immediately as something that you were going to start performing again?
No, okay. It didn't. To think in those terms felt a little exploitive to me, to be honest. But it was something that had already been part of the show, but it really began to take hold.
Well, we're going to hear that song now, True Heroes.
Yes, True Heroes, and I'd like to welcome Arkady Gips.
Arkady Gips, thank you for joining us. I want to say thanks before we go because we're going to end the show on this note.
Great, wonderful,
no
thank you.
With Frank Abrania. Frank, thanks so much for joining us for
thank
the entire
you,
hour. Appreciate it. And also Eric Nazda. Eric, thank you. And Arkady Gips, thank you for joining us. Let's listen.
We hear so much about our heroes, and how today they always seem to let us down. But every now and then we find somebody who reminds us that a few are still around. True heroes are take a look at all our problems. So many voices calling out to me and you. True heroes are the ones who always answer, just because it is the right thing to do. Are remembered for how they live each day. True heroes are measured by what they give away. Looking out for another, keeping faith despite the doubt, reaching out to help each other. Isn't that what life is all about?